The first person who speaks will be Michael Stoker, who's going to introduce Thomas Dubs. Mr. Stoker.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good afternoon. I am Attorney Michael Stoker, appearing on behalf of the petitioners in this matter, in order to introduce my co-counsel, who is appearing as under an order pro hoc vice from this court, to do the argument today, and that is Attorney Thomas Dubs of the Good Kind Labaton firm. I would yield to Mr. Dubs.
Thank you, Mr. Stoker. Mr. Dubs has been, the motion for pro hoc vice standing has been granted. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Initially, let me thank the court for admitting me pro hoc vice. I appreciate that that is not a right. It is a privilege. This appeal seeks to give the dairy farmers of this state and other states their day in court with respect to the events that flowed from the manipulation of the National Cheese Exchange and the injury that flowed to them and their families from that activity. This case arises after a 3.5-year administrative investigation by DATCAP, who had as consultants Professors Marion and Mueller from the university, two of the most preeminent dairy economists in the world. That report found after 3.5 years that Kraft and the other defendants had the motive, the opportunity, the means, and in fact they did manipulate downward the price of cheese on the National Cheese Exchange, leading to drastic injury to the dairy farmers. We submit, given that 3.5-year investigation and that report, which is in the record obviously, we come to you in a slightly different posture. We are not mere plaintiffs, but we submit we're more akin to plaintiffs who have proven a prima facie case, and now it's time to turn and see what the affirmative defenses look like. Under our system, under our free market system, price is typically determined by the supply and demand. All courts recognize that even when the law of supply and demand, the free market system, is in operation, on the margins, on the edge, we need the antitrust laws to make sure that that law of supply and demand is not tinkered with and the market is not manipulated with so that a true price comes from a free interplay of supply and demand. As an exception to that, we sometimes have industries, usually large industries such as utilities or insurance companies, who are regulated by administrative agencies. There, the price is often determined after administrative proceeding. The functional equivalent to having the antitrust laws is to have, within that administrative agency, a remedy for manipulative conduct. In the free market setting, we have the analog of policemen, police officers by the side of the road who look for speeders and reckless drivers and deter drivers from breaking the law. In the administrative context, when the price is set by the administrative agency, we have an analogous police function. It may be within the administrative agency, but we need a police function to make sure that the market, even a regulated market, is not manipulated. This court, in the Prentice decision, struck the balance and explained some of those differences, and I would like to turn to Prentice because we submit that Prentice, fairly applied and closely read, decides this case. Unlike what may be suggested, this court in Prentice did not, in a wholesale fashion, incorporate into Wisconsin law all of federal filed rate doctrine, nor did it do something even more limited, which is incorporate into Wisconsin filed rate jurisprudence Supreme Court filed rate doctrine. It did something more narrowly. And let me turn to the decision to see what that is. Because what this court said is that that its analysis was, quote, leading us to adopt the reasoning of the United States Supreme Court decision in Keough. And what the opinion shows, it applied Keough. It did not apply a mass of federal filed rate jurisprudence. It applied Keough. And how did it apply Keough? As the court said at page 725, under Keough, quote, the existence of a regulatory remedy bars a private rate-related suit for damages under the antitrust laws, regardless of whether the regulatory body approved the rates before or after the rates became effective. It went on to say, quote, like the regulatory scheme in Keough, not in federal law, in Keough, the Wisconsin Insurance Code provides a regulatory remedy which bars a private rate-related suit for damages, close quote. It goes on later to reemphasize that. It says, most importantly, those aren't my words, those are the words of this court, most importantly, Section 625.22, which is from the insurance code, grants the commissioner the power to disapprove any rate not in accordance with Section 625.11. 625.11 states that, and I'm quoting from the court's quote of the insurance statute, rates shall not be excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory, nor shall an insurer charge any rate which, if continued, will have or tend to have the effect of destroying competition or creating a monopoly, close quote. Read together, the court said, these provisions, quote, provide that the insurance commissioner shall disapprove any rate that will destroy competition. Thus, Chapter 625 provides a remedy when an insurer restrains trade in violation of Section 133.03 statutes, which is the Wisconsin Antitrust Code, which we are here on. And finally, the court said, even after it said most importantly, it was that administrative remedy, it went on to talk about the fact that the Wisconsin Insurance Code had been held by at least one court not to fall within the state action exception to antitrust laws. And they said, this determination by this other court, quote, does not change the fact that the Wisconsin Insurance Code provides the plaintiff with a remedy for the violations alleged in the present case. As pointed out previously, the insurance commissioner pursuant to Section 625.11 and 625 must, not may, must disapprove any rate which restrains trade. This court specifically held for the filed rate doctrine to be implemented and to bar a suit for damages, there must be an express administrative remedy, and not just a door to knock on, but an express administrative remedy for anti-competitive conduct. And it quite rightly came to the result because it knew that you need a police officer in the administrative agency to police the manipulative conduct. Now, in this case, there simply is no such administrative remedy under any of the Milk statutes. The defendants say, well, you could go attack the order in court. Well, that's not really a remedy. All you can do is attack the order. The order is not the problem. The problem is the manipulation at the cheese exchange. And does the United States Department of Agriculture regulate the cheese exchange? It does not. It does not. And as Willard Hurst taught many of us, we should look at the words of the statute before going to the cases. And I ask you, where is there in the Federal Milk Marketing Act anything analogous to that language in the insurance code that this court relied on, where it said that the insurance commissioner had to not file rates that were anti-competitive and could not file rates that, quote, tended to create a monopoly or otherwise have anti-monopolistic conduct. There simply is nothing in the statute or the regulatory framework that gives the dairy farmers that kind of remedy. And under Prentice, it's that degree of remedy which is essential in order to invoke the filed rate doctrine. Yes, Your Honor.
This is a very complicated case, and I'm sure my knowledge of it is about 100th percent of yours. So tell me where I've got this right and where I've got it wrong in terms of what I think this, what it seems to me this case is all about. It seems to me that what you are saying is that essentially Kraft Foods committed a fraud, and that fraud in manipulating the prices at the NCE, and that fraud in turn had an impact on the rate that was set for cheese, I guess, the FMMO, and that what you are doing, Mr. Service is doing, is attacking the rate because it was based upon a fraud. Now, why is that wrong, or why is that right?
Okay, it's wrong in a number of instances. First, we are not claiming a fraud, we're claiming
tantamount to a fraud.
Well,
they were selling a little bit, you know, losing a little bit of money here in order to make a lot of money here.
That's true. I make the distinction only because there's some cases that deal with fraud, which are dealt with somewhat separately. Anti-competitive conduct. Let's trace how the system works. And it is really not that complicated. And indeed, it is the brief of the defendants to make it complicated so everyone says, oh my God, I don't want to get into it. And and looking at the scorecard to date, that's worked. Okay, so let me start with that apologia and that introduction. How does this mechanism start? And let's look at which price is affected by agency discretion and which price is not. Because what we submit at the end of the day is that we can find a price, a number, that will permit us to calculate damages, which is not a recalculation of any rate or any number that was the product of agency discretion. So how do we begin? The whole system begins with the United States Department of Agriculture and their clerks taking a survey. A survey of cheese plants in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And those cheese plants take grade B cheese, which can't be used for milk, drinking milk, and they turn it into cheese. And these employees call them up and say, what did you buy your cheese for? And they do that 100 to 200 times. And they get that number. And that number comes from the fact that those cheese plants are looking to Green Bay to see where the cheese market is and what they should pay the farmers walking in with grade B milk that can never be drunk, that's only for cheese. So we have a number. And that number, I submit to you, is a marketplace number. And it's a marketplace number that comes as a result of the survey. Now, it takes a month to do the survey. So if we're trying to pay people in the current month, we tweak it. And how do we tweak it? Well, before May of 95, we tweaked it by doing a smaller survey. Again, real-world transactions. So we got another basic market number tweaked a little bit by another survey. Passed after May 1st, 95, we took the number from the survey and we applied a formula to it that had as one of its elements something from the National Cheese Exchange. And Judge Jones thought that that was our problem, but it's not our problem. So we tweak it that way. We get that number that results from that process is the price for cheese in the entire United States. That number is a market number. That's the number that we can use for damages calculations. That number has no administrative magic attached to it. It has no agency discretion that's been applied to it. It has nothing.
Are you saying that if you were allowed to proceed on, you would be able to show, or at least you hope could show, that the number that was arrived at was artificially low, and that artificial lowness was caused by the defendants?
Absolutely. No question about it. We take what Marion and Mueller did, we've recreated it, and basically their economic analysis said, based on the conduct, the price of cheese was so much lower than it would have been. And then it's a relatively simple matter to go from that number to the milk number that becomes cheese. And remember, we're only interested in milk that becomes cheese.
But isn't that your problem?
No.
You've got to compare that number to something, and that something is the price that was set by the FMMO.
No. We can compare that number, the cheese number, and we can correlate it with the blend price, or we can not use the blend price and still figure out how much the farmers were damaged. Should I go the next step? The next step is we have this national cheese price, and let's call it $10 a hundredweight. We add on to that price, let's say it's $2. $2 is transportation cost, so says the USDA. So that is $10 is the price for cheese, and the $12, which is called the class one differential, that becomes the price for milk that stays milk. So it's 10 bucks for milk that becomes cheese, and 12 bucks for milk that stays milk and is eventually bottled. What the U.S. Department of Agriculture does is they do a weighted average of those two numbers. And they get, let's say it's 11. And the farmer gets 11. Now we can correlate the 10 and the 11 so that there is no way that we get inside the regulatory system. On the other hand, we can use the blend price. The blend price is simply that weighted average. So when our expert is asked below, well, if it's a weighted average and I change this number and change that number, can you recalculate it? Sure, I can recalculate it, because all it is a weighted average. Now, more importantly than what anyone I submit thinks about those numbers, if the coin of the realm is agency discretion, let's see what the administrative agency says about it. With respect to the first number that comes about on the phone survey that's tweaked, and I'm quoting from page RA-585 of the record, this is what the U.S. Department of Agriculture said in its most recent order, which was litigated up to the Eighth Circuit and approved. Says, quote, federal order markets utilize an unregulated and competitive market equilibrium price that measures all economic factors affecting the supply and demand for milk and its products that captures all of the pricing criteria established by Section 608 C18. That's the administrative code that says, you, Secretary of Agriculture, you've got to worry about feed and you've got to worry about this, that, and the other thing. And what the Department of Agriculture just said is, okay, we worry about those things, but all of those things are in the market price. This price is embodied in the Minnesota-Wisconsin price. This price indicates price-quantity relationships that buyers and sellers arrive at in a market where transactions are free of government intervention. The competition for milk is the most competitive, and milk products produced compete in a national market, etc. So what the USDA is saying is that this price is a market price.
And well, are you saying that we don't have the filed rate doctrine applicable here because the FMMO is not a filed rate?
We say that it is not a filed rate system, and it is clearly not a filed rate system under Prentice for the reasons that I explored, because it doesn't have the remedy component to it. But even otherwise, it is not a filed rate system because it is not uniform. It is not comprehensive. Parts of six states are outside of it. It is in large measure voluntary. The farmers can vote themselves in and vote themselves out. The handlers have less discretion, but they still have to be asked on occasion what their view of it is. And it's never been held to be really a comprehensive nationwide system of pricing. And the most important thing that it is not a filed rate system because it at most determines a minimum, which is the blend price. And I submit to you that even the blend price, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, not me, but the U.S. Department of Agriculture at 590 in the record, they say that's a market price. So whether it is or is not, the fact of the matter is that the agency that is in charge of doing all this believes that the first price of milk that's going to become cheese, which is the NW price or the BFP, that price is a real market price, and even the blend price is a market price. And what they say on 590 is, quote, the blend price incorporates regional and national measures. It's a measure of supply and demand conditions in each order, as well as a measure of national supply and demand conditions that are reflected in the class prices based on the MW price.
Now, somewhere here I read that the way prices are determined is that there'll be a hearing, that there'll be a notice in the register, that then there'll be opportunity to comment, that they'll then fix the price, and then that has to be approved by the milk producers in the area. Is that all done here for the FMMO that we're talking about?
It is not. The way it works is this. A milk...
It's not done that way. It is not done that way.
No. What the system does is it creates an order, and that order creates the framework which I just tried to describe. And indeed, you can show up at a hearing, and indeed farmers do show up at these hearings, and there's testimony and so on. And the issue on the table is not whether there's manipulation of cheese in Green Bay. The issue is, do you vote up or down the order? Now, the orders as they have been in place for many years do what I just said. They get that price of milk that becomes cheese, and then they build a couple things off of it and nothing more. But the fact of the matter is the farmers can't come in and say, I am unhappy about the price of milk because I think Kraft is doing something funny on the National Cheese Exchange and I'm getting paid less for my milk than I want to. The order doesn't give them a relief, and the United States Department of Agriculture doesn't give them a relief. The United States Department of Agriculture is the policeman on the side of the road, and a truck goes by at breakneck speed, and someone comes up and says, well, why didn't you stop that truck? And the officer says, well, you think I'm a policeman because I have a gun and I wear a uniform and I drive in a car that has a red light, but I'm really out here because I'm looking at the asphalt on the roads, and it's somebody else's job to catch speeders. And that's the role of the United States Department of Agriculture in this whole operation. And even if you take everything that they say at face value, they say that these are market prices. And if they're market prices, and if they themselves don't claim that there's any administrative magic or determination or discretion exercised, then I submit we can do it. So we don't want to attack a rate, just to circle back. At most, we want a borrowing number that is not a number that is a number that has any administrative expertise attached to it. And alternatively, as we brought up in the Court of Appeals, we have a number that is a publicly available number that is totally outside the system. It's totally outside the system, which is the mailbox number.
Well, would it be fair to say that this, if this is not a filed rate, it is a federally sanctioned and federally utilized pricing system?
It is federally sanctioned in the sense that there is an umbrella statute. It is not federally sanctioned in the sense that the federal government, either through the U.S. Department of Agriculture or Congress, has said that one has to price milk this way. And indeed, 70% of milk is under this system. None of California's milk is under this system. Maine's milk is not under this system. And a lot of other people have been in and out over the years. So it does not come with the imprimatur of the federal government in terms of preemption, nor does it come in the imprimatur that this court, unlike the Court of Appeals mistakenly held, that they are obligated to file this as a matter of federal law which controls this court. No court has held that the federal milk marketing statutes are preemptive, and the system by design does not occupy the field for the same reasons that we've been elaborating on. It's voluntary, it's not uniform, it's not even comprehensive, and it doesn't even regulate dairy farmers, which is surprising. It only regulates the people who buy from the dairy farmers and say, you have to do such and such and such and such. It does not tell a dairy farmer, per se, it has to do anything. It lets them show up at the hearings and complain. That is true.
Counsel, let's take a case that clearly comes within the filed rate document. Railroads, I guess. Going back to Keith.
Fine.
And it is, after the rate has been filed, it is subsequently determined that in reaching that rate, the whatever agency it was fraudulently misled. What are the regulatory remedies that the plaintiffs have in that kind of case that are not available to you in this case?
Under the old
ISO. Because I take it that one of the reasons you're arguing as you are is because you don't have regulatory remedies.
We don't have any remedy. The only we don't have any remedy.
Okay, what are the remedies that that somebody clearly comes within this doctrine has that you don't have?
The answer depends upon how you cast the fact pattern. If the fact pattern is precisely as what you said, where it is fraud on the administrative agency, you can go to the administrative agency and you basically can petition the administrative agency, and they may or may not do anything. You may not bring a court case. If you're complaining of anti-competitive conduct, which is why I made the distinction a few minutes ago, that may be different. Keogh is premised in no small part on the fact that Justice Brandeis held that the people in that case, the plaintiffs, had an alternative administrative remedy which could give them money back. And the argument was, since they have that express remedy under the statute that can give them that money back, then they don't need this antitrust remedy. So in your example, they may not have a remedy, and in other cases, you do have a remedy. And the question is, if you have an antitrust claim, what kind of remedy do you have? And it depends in no small part what administrative agency you're in front of and the rule of the filed rate doctrine. And if the Wisconsin rule applies, the filed rate doctrine does not apply to bar this case because there is no express remedy within the FMO with respect to anti-competitive conduct. And if we had gone, the farmers had gone to the Secretary of Agriculture and said, there are awful things going on in Green Bay, go stop them, the Department of Agriculture would basically say, in my hypothetical, which is not far-fetched, he'd say he was looking at the asphalt and that wasn't his job. Because, you know, there was somebody up in Green Bay every half hour every Friday. It was a clerk who took down the prices. So it's not like the U.S. Department of Agriculture didn't know what the National Cheese Exchange was, but the fact is, under the statute, they can't regulate it. They can't regulate it. And so the question is, where is the remedy? And the answer is, there is no remedy if you assume that it is a classic administratively determined price mechanism system a la a utility, which it is not.
If the farmers couldn't go to the Department of Agriculture, why couldn't they go to the Federal Trade Commission or the United States Department of Justice Antitrust Commission?
They could go to the Federal Trade Commission, and the Federal Trade Commission, there's a letter saying that they looked at the report, and as a preliminary matter, they said, well, we're not sure that what the relevant market is. That there's the NCE, where they trade cash cheese, and then we know that there's some cheese traded off that, so we're not sure what the relevant market was. And frankly, if we're permitted to go that far, if we get kicked out on that ground, so be it. The second reason, which in this factual situation is more telling, is the timeline. This report came out in the spring of 1986. There was some hullabaloo. There was some congressional hearings. The governor appointed a task force. And towards the end of 1997, towards the beginning of 1997, there was a fair amount of controversy as to how this operated. And by May, what happened? The National Cheese Exchange had closed its doors. So your remedy from the federal government is at most an injunction, which in this case is a practical matter, was effectively mooted out. So in order to get compensation, they brought these antitrust cases, and in order to create deterrence in the future, you need the deterrent power of the antitrust laws on the sidelines, policing the marketplace so that the dairy farmers have protection. They did not have protection before. They need protection both going back and going forward. I noticed the red light is on here.
Mr. Dobbs, what years are you seeking damages for?
We go back under the statute of limitations roughly from 86 to 80. 90 to 90. The report came out in 96. We go back 6 years.
So it's what years are you seeking damages?
1990 or 91 through when the cheese exchange closed in
97. That's about 97. And when were the producer mailbox prices available?
95, Your Honor.
1995.
But we can go back by statistically dealing with that so that it's effectively the same price series but going back. All of these pricing issues, once we find a number that is not a number that is cloaked with administrative discretion, even if it is a file rate system, and it is not, then we can, from that number, derive what we need to derive. And it's unfortunate that that's wagging the dog, but that seems to be where we are.
Justice Brasser.
I don't know quite how to ask this, but one of the plaintiffs in this case, as I understand it, this is a class action. One of the named plaintiffs is a farmer from Georgia. I just don't quite understand why a farmer from Georgia is relying on Wisconsin antitrust law.
The answer to that is that one applies the law that governs the conduct. The conduct here was in Green Bay every Friday morning. The Georgia farmer is coming into Wisconsin and saying that conduct, which was illegal, was governed by your law. Since governed by your law, I can come into your courts and try to enforce your law because it impacted me, even though I'm sitting in Georgia.
But isn't this interstate commerce?
It is interstate commerce. But the fact is, whether it's interstate commerce or not, we cannot bring an action under the federal antitrust laws.
Why?
Because of what's called the Illinois BRIC rule. In your typical antitrust case, you have a manufacturer, a wholesaler, a retailer, and a consumer. The Supreme Court, in a case called Illinois BRIC, said that the only person who can bring an antitrust suit in federal court is the one closest to the injury. So if the manufacturer was colluding or engaging in unlawful monopolistic conduct, the only person who could bring a lawsuit would be the wholesaler. Wisconsin, in its wisdom, along with about 17 other states, after the Illinois BRIC decision came down, passed a law called an Illinois BRIC repealer. That's the jargon. And so 133 states, the persons who were injured under the Wisconsin antitrust laws, directly or indirectly, can sue for antitrust damages. So that those down the chain can sue. Now, in this instance, I mean, one of the anomalies of the case, since we're into it, is that if we had a co-op, these problems would be there, because the co-ops turn the milk into cheese, and then you have your direct correlation, cheese down, National Cheese Exchange, less money for cheese at the co-op. It's only because we are one step down with the farmers who are selling the milk to the cheese manufacturer that we get this. So net-net, there is no private federal antitrust remedy, even though it is in interstate commerce. Two, you have the issue of how do you deal with out-of-state dairy farmers coming in, availing themselves of your law, and that is an issue that is in part intertwined with the class issue. But you do not have the problem. You do not have the problem that appears in many of the class actions, which is that you're applying different laws to everybody. You got one group that has this law, another group that has that law. This whole thing is governed by Wisconsin antitrust law because the bad conduct was in Green Bay, and that's where it was. And so if that bad conduct, if there's going to be compensation flowing from that bad conduct, it is only under the Wisconsin antitrust statute.
But I assume that there are different marketing orders for different regions, and therefore the Georgia farmer might have a different, ultimately different damages than the Wisconsin farmer.
That is true, but remember, to go back, the price for milk that becomes cheese that comes out of the survey, that's a nationwide price. But the answer is, if you look at the blend price, yes, you will. I mean, the economics are essentially this, that the price of milk that became cheese during this time period was, I used 10 in my hypothetical, it was really about 11. The difference between the price of milk that's going to become cheese and the price of milk that stays milk has historically been about $3, and that has been remarkably consistent over time. Now, the farmer in Wisconsin gets a buck in addition to that, and the farmer in Georgia or Florida may get more, but the fact of the matter is, it's all, that part is all arithmetic. That is all simply claim forms in arithmetic. It is not choice of law issues, and it's not worrying about, you know, where you have an airplane crash and people, you got passengers from all over the country and you've got to apply 50 different wrongful death statutes. It's nothing like that.
When it's established, thank you, Chief. Maybe more out of curiosity than anything, and maybe to show my ignorance. If we should decide that filed rate doctrine does not apply to you, is that a federally appealable decision?
No. The only redress would be an argument to the Supreme Court that somehow Wisconsin law is preempted, which would be a dramatic decision since there's been no decision other than one decision that went the other way, which is the Florida Line decision cited in our brief, holding that the federal milk marketing statute or the agricultural statute in general that covers more than milk is preemptive. So with that exception, the answer is there is no way to get into the federal system on this issue. The court's been very generous with its time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dubs. You know, a few minutes of rebuttal. Mr. Topink is going to introduce Jeff W. Smith of Kirkland and Ellis, Chicago, representing Kraft Foods, etc.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Ralph Topink of Quarles and Brady, representing defendant respondent Kraft Foods, Inc., and I am here today to introduce Mr. Jeff Smith of Kirkland and Ellis, who has been admitted pro hac vice, and with the court's indulgence will argue on behalf of all the respondents.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Smith.
Good afternoon, Your Honor, and may it please the court. We have some physical exhibits that the marshal will pass up that were used both at the argument that was held at the trial court level and at the argument at the appellate court level. And it is here.
These are in your appendix, aren't they?
They are in our appendix as well. That is correct, Your Honor. Now, what plaintiffs ask is for this court to reject the considered judgment of an experienced and respected trial judge that he reached after a lengthy, indeed, almost all-day hearing, at which Mr. Dubs argued very differently from where he argued today, on an extensively briefed motion for summary judgment. And that took place 2 years into the case, and after the plaintiffs had filed two amended complaints, there was a full opportunity for discovery. And based upon that record and the motion for summary judgment supported by 14 affidavits and very substantial paperwork, which of course you've seen a large portion of it in the record here, that the filed rate doctrine foreclosed plaintiff's case in its entirety. And under section 802.08 of the summary judgment rule, your ruling here is governed by the evidentiary record that was there before the Judge Jones when he ruled as he did, and not what Mr. Dubs here in this courtroom, which is quite frankly a new theory I heard today, different from anyone that I've heard before in all from his other counsel at the Court of Appeals. Now, it is very clearly begun if you just look at, and this was the problem that the judge focused upon. If you just look at this first chart, the issue is how does the fact that there was a manipulation, an alleged manipulation of price on this little cheese exchange that controls, that involved the sale of less than 0.2% of the cheese in the United States affect the price of milk for sold for all purposes by all dairy farmers in America. That was the key question. Now, originally in this case, the plaintiffs in their original complaints alleged that milk dairy farmers had contracts that specifically referenced the NCE price as a basis for determining their milk prices. And we said, there is no such evidence. And before we even got to the point of moving for summary judgment on that point, they amended their complaint. And they said, there is a method. And what was the method that they said? We put it to them. The method they said, this is not us talking. This is them talking. If you just look at the second sheet there, this is the key sheet, because this is what they said in their memorandum in opposition, and again, this is a motion for summary judgment. The summary judgment bell here had rung. They had an obligation under Section 802 to not rest upon mere allegations or denials, but the adverse party's response by affidavit or otherwise provided in this section must set forth specific facts showing that there's a genuine issue for trial. So here's what they said in their brief. Is because the USDA uses the NCE price in calculating the FMO price floor for milk, plaintiffs receive less money for the milk than they would have absent defendants' manipulation. And of course, the filed rate doctrine, as was ruled in Prentice, says even if those manipulations are alleged to be true, now they've been rejected, as Mr. Dubs admitted, by the FTC, the Attorney General, Mr. O'Connor's office, never brought a claim on any of this, and these allegations have been made for a long time. We categorically deny them, but even if true, which we accepted for purposes of the motion for summary judgment, the fact of the matter is that they there then say that the next step that they take, and this was Mr. Dubs' comment today about a relatively simple mathematical computation, is if the court holds the NCE prices, the simple result will be a mathematical recalculation of what? The federal milk marketing order prices.
Well, what's the matter with recalculating it if it isn't a filed rate?
Because it is a rate that is a reasonable rate that is set by and approved by an administrative agency, in this case, a federal agency. And the case...
Let me just stop you for a
pardon?
Minute. I'm just going to stop you.
Yes.
My question was, is your defense that this is a filed rate?
My defense is that the filed rate doctrine controls here, and a filed rate under the filed rate doctrine means, it's a little bit of a misnomer, filed rate. It means, as was put by, and this is quoting the language from the Arkansas-Louisiana gas case, which was cited in Prentice as the basis for the rationale in adopting the rule in Prentice. Simply put, and I'm quoting, and this is quoted from Prentice as well, the filed rate doctrine prohibits a party from recovering damages measured by comparing the filed rate and the rate that might have been approved absent the conduct in issue. It amounts to nothing less than the award of a retroactive rate increase based on speculation about what the commission might have done faced with the facts of the case.
I want to know.
That is what the Supreme Court and Prentice says is what is prohibited. And that is exactly what was presented, Your Honor, to Judge Jones by Mr. Dubs.
In Prentice, the court concluded, I dissented, but the court concluded that there was a rate established by the Insurance Commission. And that was by definition, reasonable, and therefore it was a filed rate, and the filed rate doctrine applied. Here, we've got a minimum value set by the government.
The price that they say that they want to have recalculated, yes.
Let's just accept that for the moment.
Okay.
They can recalculate it, I assume.
Mathematically, it can be recalculated. Any rate can be recalculated.
Okay, but I'm assuming that they can recalculate it without violating the filed rate doctrine if this doesn't
absolutely they cannot. They absolutely cannot by the very statement that you just heard from the United States Supreme Court as adopted by the majority opinion in the Prentice case.
Well, I have a lot of trouble analogizing some of the energy cases to this case because I'm not sure that the same rate structure and the same federal rules are applied there as they are here. So my question to you will be, why is this under the filed rate doctrine when it is a minimum? It doesn't regulate prices above the minimum, is that right?
It does not regulate prices. People, although as Judge Jones quickly pointed out, how can they have it both ways? They can't say, oh, well, the price was there, but we got more money. So there was a little bit of a disconnect there. But yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
So what other cases do you have where you've got a minimum set by the federal government and then that fits under the final?
Well, there are a whole series of cases that don't even involve the allegations of a fixing of a rate. The Burning case from the Ninth Circuit involved an order from this same Department of Agriculture under the same 1937 Act where it was a regulation that restricted the output of hops, and it was alleged that the hops people had conspired and fixed to get that output set anti-competitively, and the filed rate doctrine was applied there because their damages involved deciding what it would have been like if the administrator's decision had been different in light of the allegation. It was specific there and didn't involve it. If you look at the Goldwasser case, you look at the Wegoland case, which are both telephone-related cases, both of them involved conduct that wasn't directly related to rates, but affected rates. And then the people were seeking a change. And it is exactly that.
Were the rates fixed there by the government, so you had to use those rates only?
The rates were there as here fixed. The only difference here is that as the statute provides expressly, the statute provides that, and it doesn't provide, it directs the Secretary of Agriculture shall determine a price or a method for determining price. And that's where here what happened was that the Secretary of Agriculture. Of Agriculture, the USDA, held hearings about what should the formula be. Mr. Dubs misrepresented the fact that this whole process begins with some clerk going around taking a survey. Absolutely to the contrary. It begins with a notice to all dairy farmers and all other affected people that there will be a hearing, an evidentiary hearing, on what will be the terms of the order. And at that hearing, there's evidence presented. And indeed, the Glickman case, which he cited, is fascinating on this point because that involved a challenge to a determination by the Secretary of Agriculture to include in
the orders that we're applying, the adoption of this MW reference point in determining what the minimum price was going to be throughout the country. And they objected on the grounds that they didn't like it because it unfairly, they alleged, discriminated against upper Midwestern farmers. And the court reviewed the whole thing, and it wasn't an up or down, you're going to accept the order or not accept the order. So consistent with what Your Honor even said in your dissent in Prentice, this is an actively used remedy that exists under the statute. So you have that. And here, even more direct on point, and we have it in the record, is that it was interesting in the hearings in 1992 that the U.S. Department of Agriculture held on modifications of the order. There was express discussion in the hearings about the fact that some people complained that trading on the National Cheese Exchange was too thin. The whole issue was presented, and the Department of Agriculture went on and made a determination expressly to incorporate into the formula the National Cheese Exchange. Now, an interesting but potentially odd point is that Kraft opposed including the National Cheese Exchange in the formula. And dairy farmers wanted it. And it is a matter of record here before Judge Jones that the Dairy Farmers of America, the largest dairy organization in the United States and in this area as well, stood up in court and said their whole theory of liability, not even their question of the filed rate doctrine, their whole theory that this thing was manipulated has no merit.
Counsel, we take for purposes of this hearing, I think, and this review, that there was misconduct, that there was manipulation.
We accept that,
correct?
We accept that.
My concern, in part, lies with the remedy. Now, my understanding is that the National Cheese Exchange is defunct, and I presume that if the filed rate doctrine, if it were not defunct, and the filed rate doctrine were held to bar such a case, the parties or the government could go in and ask for injunctive relief to get at this misconduct. But since the National Cheese Exchange is defunct, injunctive relief makes no sense. Is there no remedy available for misconduct that we are taking for purposes of this hearing to have occurred? Or is that conduct in some way, in this case, immunized?
It's certainly not immunized. And it also, your question goes to a question of at what point in time? Back in 1992, when these allegations were being made in the hearings that the United States Department of Agriculure had, somebody could have filed, including the dairy farmers that are here, they could have gone in and sought injunctive relief. They brought their action in 1995. Originally, they brought it earlier. They could have sought injunctive relief. They did not. There, at any point, we could have been criminally prosecuted. The government could have sued. But in every single filed rate doctrine case, the remedy of damages has been held not to be available.
What remedy is available for this lawsuits before us filed post-1995? What remedy is available in order to address misconduct?
Well, the remedy government remedies that we could be criminally prosecuted, and at this point in 2002, there is no injunctive relief that is available. that was a choice they made back when they filed their complaint not to seek injunctive relief, because when the complaint was filed, the National Cheese Exchange was still in existence, and they could have done that. That was an election that they made at that time.
Were these filed when, in 97? Are these cases 97?
Well, the original cases, they filed these cases originally back in 1995, and then they filed their amended complaints. Actually have the exact schedule if it's important. But I think the Marion and Mueller report on which they base their case, admittedly, and which notably the Marion Mueller report says that the linkage that they saw was based upon the federal milk marketing order system. That was the only linkage they identified, and that's at record RA-176. Is where that site is.
Let me ask a different question. Again, dealing with in part with the non-existence of the National Cheese Exchange. If part of the purpose of all of this this file rate doctrine is to maintain the integrity of the rate, the regulatory scheme and the rate, if the National Cheese Exchange no longer exists, then what integrity is there to protect?
It's the
no
integrity,
longer is part of the formula.
It's the integrity of the administrative process and the judicial process. But you have to understand there are three prongs to the filed rate doctrine. Number one is deference to administrative agencies. And I commend the decision of Kimblewood in the Wagoland case, which was affirmed by adopting her opinion by the Second Circuit. They go through it very clearly. Number one is that the legislature has made a determination, here the Congress, that what should be the price that's paid for milk should be determined by the Department of Agriculture, because there are a series of issues that they're trying to deal with, and those are set out in our brief and are set out in the statute. Orderly markets, encouraging farmers to be able to produce fluid milk. Secondly, that you put judges and jurors in a hopeless position of speculating as to what that agency would have done with its expertise if it had been faced with the facts. And third, virtually all of these regulatory systems call for uniform prices, and that is true of the federal milk marketing order system, and to allow some group to get more money than others would distort that uniformity of system. So those are the principles that would be trashed, in my judgment, trashed, if this court were to sit there and say on this record that, oh no, we can go back and recalculate now what the Department of Agriculture decided back through evidentiary hearings and everything else. It would trash the whole system of administrative agency delegation of authority, as well as, of course, in my judgment, the arguments being made here are new. They weren't even made before Judge Jones, and it would trash the whole process of summary judgment in Wisconsin courts if, after two amended complaints, 2 years, no request for any additional discovery, you can come in and say, well, okay, now I have a theory. That's what it is. The producer mailbox theory. And when was that theory presented to this court? Not even in the petition. It was presented for the first time in their briefs. And then here's Mr. Dubs offering new theories. He's now saying, well, we only are talking about milk use for cheese. It's
not
what I heard.
Maybe I'm not as offended by it as you apparently are.
I am offended by it.
Obviously. Let me try this. This is an antitrust cause of action. And the bar is, who look, you can lay out all the elements of an antitrust cause of action, and you have them there. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But the problem is, the bar is, you can't get any damages, because the damages that you are seeking necessarily rely on damages that are implicated by a regulatory system and established by a minimum pricing in that regulatory system. It's not that you didn't aver the correct conduct in antitrust in your complaint or amended complaint, but you can't get the kind of damages. So they're saying, okay, we have all the allegations that we need to describe the anti-competitive conduct, and we're going to seek damages, but we're not even going to talk. But there's not going to be one word about the National Cheese Exchange in our case in proving damages. Not one word. There's not going to be one word about the minimum pricing as set. We're going to prove damages by showing, by showing other bases for our loss. Mm-hmm. So what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is that I filed a motion for summary judgment and challenged them to come forth with what their theory was. And they came forth with nothing other than the federal milk marketing order system and an argument that, well, it shouldn't apply here. And they have offered nothing else. I mean, even today, all they're offering is a promise of something in the future. And indeed, at the court of... Mr. Dubs was specifically asked in response. I had a big version of this thing sitting up there. And this argument went on for hours, and we were back and forth. And I walked over to this chart, and I sat there. I challenged Mr. Dubs to tell me what else he has. And he got up, and he didn't answer it. And the judge asked him, and he didn't have anything else. And at the argument at the Fourth Circuit, Mr. Gustafson, his associated counsel, was asked the same thing. And he said, I have a model.
Well, I think...
And then now we have this
damages,
latest thing.
I think of proving damages in several ways. If I were an employee who lost my job, and I wanted to try to show my hourly rate, I could look at the other employees that are on the line next to me and use that as a measure. And if I were told, no, you can't use that, that's set by some federal rate, then I would say, okay, I'm going to bring in a study done by some professor from Illinois with lots of letters behind his name, and he's going to say what the value of it is, regardless of what the...
And that's what they did with Marion and Mueller. They sit there and say, Marion and Mueller is what we base our case on. And what did Marion Mueller say is how you make this leap from this little bit of cheese trading to an effect on all the milk sold in America. And indeed, it's interesting because at various different times they said the Canevel bar, that's that case out in California that we have as well, it either applies or it doesn't apply. But in Canevel bar, they don't make any bones about it. They sit there and say, we know that the only way we can make this leap is the fact that in California, which has a separate regulatory, state regulatory system that uses, similar to the federal milk marketing order system, the National Cheese Exchange as part of the formula. That's our only basis for getting the leap. And that is the only thing that's in the record. Sure, anybody can dream up any theory of damages. I've tried a lot of cases. I know Your Honor has tried a lot of cases. And there are lots of ways to try and go about proving damages. But when, at some point, you got to say, what are you going to prove? And that has to happen at summary judgment. And the fact of the matter is that there's nothing else been offered, and indeed there really isn't nothing else. But you don't have to rule in this case that there may not be some other thing. The simple fact is they had a burden under Section 802 to come forward with specific facts, and they did not do so. And that, I mean, it may not offend Your Honor, But to me, as a person who has to litigate day in, day out in the courts of America, if summary judgment means nothing, we are going to bury the populace in litigation expense. It may be great for my children, but it's not good for America. And that is what they seek to do here, is they seek to keep trying to dance to the point, and I am offended that they would raise something to the Supreme Court of Wisconsin in their brief, not even in their petition. That violates an express rule of the court, that you cannot raise arguments that were not raised in your petition. So, you know, I mean, that's where I come at it. And this is so classically filed rate doctrine. I mean, this fits directly.
Just, let's talk about that.
I'm ready.
To me, it isn't classically filed rate doctrine. The people involved here didn't file a rate with the government, which the government then approves, which then governs everybody. To me, that's classical filed
rate. Okay, but here they did. Exactly. They did exactly everything that you just articulated. Because what we were required to do was we had to file the prices that we paid with the Department of Agriculture.
Who's
we? We, the sellers, the buyers of milk, Kraft. We had to file that. There's a system. It's after the fact, but so was the situation in Prentice. It was after the fact. So we had to file what prices we paid. Those prices were paid, and they were mandatory. We have no discretion. We have to pay them. The dairy farmers have an ability to voluntarily opt out of the system, but as far as Kraft is concerned, the people who have to pay the price, it is mandatory. And
you can pay above the price?
Do we pay above the price?
And
we can and have. And that's not what they're complaining about. They're complaining that they didn't get the minimum price.
I understand that. But I'm reading from Square D Company versus Niagara Frontier Tariff Bureau. The United States Supreme Court said, the legal rights of the shipper as against the carrier in respect to a rate are measured by the published tariff. Unless and until suspended or set aside, this rate is made for all purposes the legal rate as between the carrier and the shipper. The right as defined by the tariff cannot be varied or enlarged by either contract or tort of the carrier. That's not true here. You can vary it. You can go above that price, right?
Yes, but the point of that thing is of that decision there was sitting there looking at the specific rate. All you have to do is look at any of these other cases that have dealt with that issue in a myriad of different contexts, all of which have found in circumstances that aren't even remotely as comprehensive, direct as we are facing here. I mean, all you have to do is read the Glickman decision that sits there and talks about there is no more Byzantine, complicated system of regulation than is the federal milk marketing order system.
It's a support system, a price support system. Isn't it?
It is much more than a price support system because there is a separate price support system that has a minimum price for a variety of things. This is a system that by statute is designed to elevate prices above the competitive level in order to encourage small dairy farmers to stay in business and produce milk for fluid, drinkable milk. It is a very comprehensive system, all designed not for the benefit of people like Kraft, but for the benefit of dairy farmers. And that is why the dairy farmers of America have sat there and said, this case stinks.
Any higher price that would be paid would be influenced by the federal minimum.
Absolutely. Right. That's correct. So that's where they acknowledge that.
Perhaps you could, and this is in a follow-up to the chief's question, explain how the regulatory remedy would work if it had been invoked by the farmers.
Okay, they can, if even one-third of the dairy farmers in an area object, they can mandate They, one-third, remember it takes two-thirds to approve. If one-third object to anything, they can mandate that the Department of Agriculture hold hearings.
For purposes of recalculating.
Of recalculation, going back, refiguring, rejiggering the whole thing so that they could have gone in and said, we want that cheese exchange thing pulled out of the formula. We don't want any reference to that at all because we think it's bad.
They can litigate the alleged anti-competitive conduct in that forum in order to get the cheese exchange component of it pulled out.
Absolutely, which is what happened and is in the record of the fact that we that issue was raised and in the hearings in 1992. And then if they don't hold a hearing, they can bring a lawsuit like the Glickman lawsuit to compel them to hold hearings, to revisit the issue. They can bring an action to enjoin the parties from going ahead and pursuing it. That's not an administrative remedy. That's a separate action that they could have done. Within the administrative remedies, they could have asked for rehearing of the order, and they could have sued and done that. Okay, that's it. At RA 392 is the record citation for where that authority exists as an administrative remedy.
Question. Mr. Smith, I inferred from something that Mr. Dubb said early that there was some cooperation between the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture and these plaintiffs. Is that correct?
I have no knowledge of any specific cooperation between the department, the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture and these plaintiffs. I know it was the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture that asked the Federal Trade Commission to review the Marion Mueller report, and the Federal Trade Commission didn't just sit there and say, oh, well, we can't define a relevant market. They said they saw no antitrust violation on the Marion Mueller report. But I don't know of any specific cooperation that has existed. I know my time is up.
You have another question, sir.
Got another question. If you did reach it, I didn't hear it. Could you explain the point of this exhibit?
Yes. The point of that exhibit is that this was their theory of causation. This is how they expected to span this gap here. And they said the way they were going to expand that gap was that they would mathematically recalculate the federal milk marketing order price. And then their expert, they offered one expert on the federal milk marketing, and he confirmed that, and if you look at, I think, the next sheet that's in that package there is this diagram that attempts, and I think relatively well, to visually portray the federal milk marketing order system. And you see there, it refers to blend price, which is what people like Kraft have to pay, is the blend price. That's the mandatory minimum price. And Mr. Conover said that in explaining what was meant by what was stated in the plaintiff's brief, he said, I think this infers that there would be a change in the class prices, and if there were, that would be a mathematical recalculation to arrive at the increased blend price. So that was the purpose of it, was to show this is their damage, this is their causation theory that implicates the filed rate doctrine.
Oh, okay. So
that's the point.
That's the point, then. That, in fact, the plaintiff is absolutely tied in with the FMMO, and that, therefore, absolutely ties this in as being a filed rate doctrine case.
Correct.
Okay. I ask one other question.
Yes, Mr. Brassman.
Mr. Dubbs mentioned the Illinois brick case.
Yes.
Does the Illinois brick case, which I fully admit I didn't understand, does that in any way bar a federal agency, like the
Department of Justice? No, absolutely does not.
Antitrust or the State Department of Justice?
Does not.
Thank you,
Thank
counsel.
You.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Dubs.
Thank you, Your Honor. At the trial court and here, the defendants have attempted to saddle us with a theory of causation, which is simply not the case. We have to remember there are two factors. Where this begins is the simple fact that 95% of the bulk cheese sold in America is formula priced off the NCE. And it's a nit, whether it's a written contract, an oral contract, or in an invoice. That's what Mary and Mueller have found. So even though a minute amount of cheese is traded on the National Cheese Exchange, what makes it so deadly is that is the lever on which cheese is bought throughout the entire country. And once you discover that a so-called market that is open a half an hour a week can be manipulated, you can thereby drive down the price of cheese nationwide. It is a unique set of circumstances.
But you do it by using the order, the FMMO.
No, you don't do it by driving. You drive down the price of cheese by selling cheese on the National Cheese Exchange. That has two consequences. If you're a buyer of cheese, it has the consequence, because it's all formula-based, of driving down your input costs. On the other side of it, as you will, it basically sets the bogey for what the people are doing who answer the phone survey and say what they pay for cheese. So it comes into the system two ways. Now, the way they say it comes into the system, and the only way they say it comes into the system, is via the tweaker. That after you do the phone survey, you tweak it with a formula that has as one of its components the NCE. But I tell you that even lawyers from New York know that if you depress the price of cheese, it's going to have an ineluctable impact on the price of milk, and you don't need a USDA tweaker to transmit that. But that is a self-evident proposition. But that is what the theory of causation that they wanted to limit us to. This is not classic file.
Are you trying to recover damages for not getting enough for your cheese, or are you trying to recover damages for not getting enough for your milk?
We are interested in recovering damages only for milk that becomes cheese. Okay. Milk that stays milk, we don't claim for.
Right.
Okay?
But it's milk, not cheese.
Well, it's milk because that's what dairy farmers sell. If we would have had a cheese manufacturing plaintiff who would step forward, that would be the case. The problem is that some of the co-ops don't want to do it. And by the way, Mr. Smith didn't tell you that the Dairy Farmers of America is owned by Borden, which I think is an interesting footnote point. So, at least it was at the trial court level. Well, let me...
All right, gentlemen. Counsel.
What this is it's not classic filed rate, it's radical filed rate, because there is no case in filed rate jurisprudence that applies to a minimum. It's not there. The whole guts of the system are you have an administrative agency that weighs costs and says, that is the price you're going to pay for electricity, that is the price you're going to pay to ship your goods on the railroad. There is no case fairly read in American jurisprudence that approves a minimum. So this is not classic filed rate, this is radical filed rate. But what the case can be cited decided in a non-radical way by the simple application of Prentice. Because Prentice did not incorporate Arkansas, the case doesn't cite that, it cites Square D. But if you apply Keogh as in the Prentice case, then one of the requirements is there has to be an express administrative remedy so that the dairy farmers have some redress. There has to be a policeman somewhere. Where is the police officer? If he's not by the side of the road, maybe he can be inside the administrative agency. That's fine. But what Kraft wants is no police officer anywhere. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture is not
a true remedy. And getting back to Your Honor's point, if you look at those cases, number one, to go back to my Professor Hurst's point, the statute itself has nothing in it that is akin to what is in the Wisconsin Insurance Code, which was the pivot point for this court's decision in Prentice. It's not there.
Where is the regulatory procedure found?
The regulatory procedure is found in 608C. And the fact of the matter is, yes, the farmers can go and they can complain and their hearings and all that, but what's the end point? The end point is not, and this is an important point, the end point is not, we don't like what's going on in the National Cheese Exchange, go stop it, Department of Agriculture. At most, it is, we will turn down the order. So where does that leave the farmers? They have no protection, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture does not have the statutory authority to go up and stop the anti-manipulative conduct, even if it wants to. The point that Mr. Smith was making is a very narrow point, which is that if they had gone in and said, we love the order, the only thing we don't like about the order is the little tweaker from the NCE, then conceivably that could have been taken out. But that's adding insult to injury. That's the pimple on the elephant, because what was really going on was much more massive than that, which was the manipulation on the exchange. And put simply, to repeat myself, the United States Department of Agriculture could not stop manipulation on the National Cheese Exchange, even if it wanted to.
It was not regulated. Now, defendants here filed, Quarles and Brady filed a reply to the Attorney General's amicus brief. And as I read the reply, they say the AG's got it all wrong because the AG is looking at the National Cheese Exchange and looking at filed rate doctrine for that, not looking at the FMMO. What's your view of the AG's brief, which seems to be very simple?
Our view is that the AG's brief is very simple in the most powerful sense of the term, and that they're quite right, that the NCE is not regulated by the United States Department of Agriculture, and the filed rate doctrine has historically dealt with antitrust issues where there have been conspiracies alleged or anti-manipulative conduct that have affected the rate, and that's simply not this case. And it's at most an issue of damages as to how we got into this thing. We're not attacking a rate. We want to borrow a number, and we want to borrow a number that the U.S. Department of Agriculture says is a market number. They don't say it's a number blessed with anything. The final point we have is, which we will rely on the briefs for, is that co-op transactions are never in the system. So we should be able to recover for co-op transactions because they are never under the Federal Milk Marketing Order system. And Judge Jones and the court below did not deal with that adequately, and they said that because of some issue of causation, they were somehow implicated. That's simply not true. Under the filed rate doctrine, even its classical interpretation, one must parse out those transactions which are fairly under the regulatory framework and ones that were not, and that did not happen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Dobbs, and thank you, Mr. Smith and Stoker and Topinka. You gentlemen have been on this case a while, I gather. And...